They looked at me as one of the most dangerous people at the time in Monroe County. That year was the bloodiest year ever in Monroe history. It was six murders. Mm. So they looked at me a little different when it came to that. So I had the belly chains and there's a black box that goes around your hands and you can't move or you can't stand up straight like that. So they took me by myself. And so when you get there, I mean, it's like it's humiliation because they strip you down and spray you with the hoses and putting this really bad smelling soap on you, disinfectant stuff. And so you really start feeling like that subhuman. And that's how you feel the whole time you're in prison.
This is the Made to Advance podcast. I'm your host, Brian Olick. We're here to inspire and equip you for your best future. Well, I've been looking forward to this conversation for a long time. I have my friend Dennis Neckel with me today, and he serves as the production manager at the Gateway Center of the Holland Rescue Mission. And I'm excited for you to hear his journey and his story. So, Dennis, welcome to Made to Advance.
Well, it's awesome to be here.
Yeah, and I just learned you play guitar. I was overhearing the conversation. Acoustic or electric?
Acoustic and electric, both.
Okay, do you have a preference?
Well, I'm really into the classical guitar right now. I do a lot of Spanish type stuff.
Really?
I come across a German company.
Yeah.
And this guitar is like the old Spanish way they used to make them.
Okay.
And so I just really love it. So.
Have you played, there's like a 12-string guitar. There's normal guitar, six-string. Have you played a 12-string before?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I see guys play 12 strings, and I'm like, I don't even know how you, have you, is it hard or is it?
No, it's. You don't really do leads on 12 strings. It's just doing rhythm.
Okay.
So you play the same type of chords.
Yeah.
It's just different octaves of the chord, the strings. That's really basically all it is. So.
And at home, do you have like on the electric guitar side of things, do you have like pedals and the whole workup or do you keep it simple?
No, I like the Vox amp. And so my Vox amp's got all the effects all built in there.
Okay.
And then I have a pedal, like a switchboard, so you can kind of, make your own sounds and everything. So
nice.
I kind of like that because I don't play out anymore.
Yeah.
It's more kind of my entertainment, just praising God.
Yeah.
So it's a little smaller scale.
Yeah, that's cool. We have a old, like an acoustic, or I don't even know if acoustic's the right word, but piano in our basement. And I used to play, and I was in a band. People don't know this about me. I was in a band called The Adopted, okay, in high school. And we had gigs, and sometimes we even got paid, which just blows your mind.
Yeah.
When you're doing a gig, and you're like, they're paying me for. This. Did you pay gigs ever or not?
Only one time at Studio Lounge, in Wayne County area.
Yeah.
But that's it. That's Battle of the Bands.
Okay, that's cool. Yeah, that was a fun era. Like we were doing Pearl Jam, and we did some Beatles, and we did all kinds of different groups, but. I think that I would rather I was a keyboard player. I think, the whole, guitar thing is like definitely the cooler instrument, but still today, I guess this is what made me think of it. I'll go to my basement sometimes and like get chord charts out and just sing and play. And, I don't know. It does something good for your heart, doesn't it?
Oh yeah. Yeah, yeah. Definitely. It's therapy.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Well, we first met when I was serving, one day at the Gateway Center. And you were giving me a tour around the facilities, and it was just super cool to see everything happening there. And in the process, you started sharing a little bit of your story with me, and I thought, man, it would be really cool for us to have an opportunity to talk like this and for other people to hear more of what you've been through and what your life has been like and kind of how it's played out. So let's go all the way back, and maybe we could just start with you telling me a little bit about your childhood.
Well, I grew up, pretty poor. My dad went to prison when I was 5 years old. And so my mom, she graduated from high school, but really didn't have a whole lot of skills or anything. Mm-hmm. So the man of the house being gone, so we lived pretty poor, struggled for, food to eat. We got kicked out of a lot of apartments. Mm-hmm. We lived in abandoned apartments at times. I remember one time we was living in a place that was like, condemned, and my aunt had hit the floor with a hammer at night so the rats would not come and chew on you because they will.
Wow.
And that was kind of crazy. But that's kind of how we lived. And so we ended up going to school, but not have a shower or anything. And so that was kind of embarrassing going to school like that because, you know, you look down your own arm, your arms are dirty and everything. And you missed a lot of school, too, so you was behind. And on top of that, at the time, I didn't know I had narcolepsy back then. But now that I look back, that's probably some of the reason why I fell asleep in classes and so forth. And so school wasn't very good for me. And so as time go by, my dad was in prison. At 9.5 years old, he passed away. Not sure exactly how that happened. Some people say he was murdered. I'm not really sure about that.
Did you guys maintain relationship while he was in prison, or was he pretty much fully out of your life?
Yeah, he's pretty much fully out of our life, yeah. And so after that, my mom married like 3 more times after that. Basically, that's the same man, but they look different. They was all abusers. They drank all the money up, so there was never any food or anything like that. And so I just remember, you know, even walking down the street a couple of times, and this might be gross to some people, but you're starving, you eat anything, and eating chewable, you know, people's chew gum off the ground. I've done that before when I was a kid, eat out of garbage cans and stuff, you know. And so that's one thing, you know, what I do now at Gateway, I try to show that, you know, just by doing like one bail, you're taking care of a little kid that needs some food or some clothing, you know. To me, that's when I, you know, step out and do that kind of work at work. That's what I think about, that little boy that needs something to eat, like, you know, like, yeah. I was. He has something to eat now because I did this bail. And to me, that means a lot. It makes me want to do more of it because of that reason.
And that, and when you're talking about a bail, you're talking about clothing that has come into the Gateway Center.
Yeah.
You guys will bail it up. If it doesn't go into the store for resale, then it will get bailed up and sent somewhere for what happens then when that gets.
Yeah, so I mean, what happens is after 5 weeks, we have a color code in the store. After 5 weeks, it doesn't sell. It comes back. Some of it gets repriced again. So we try to make as much money as we can off that so we can, you know, put it back into the ministry. And some will go to the bailers. When that gets bailed, the bale weighs about 1,000 pounds, a little bit over that. 40 of them go onto a truck and they go to Canada. And when they go to Canada, they get broken down as recycled threads, and some will go through our country for clothing and so forth, too. So it's a good thing. It's our way of giving back.
Gotcha. That makes sense.
Yeah.
So you've started out, and you're, even as a young guy, obviously lots of trauma in your background, and from your mom's husbands to a shortage of resources and food and whatnot. And then in your teenage years, you really start to go through, maybe get into trouble a little bit. It's not just the challenges at home, but you start getting into some trouble. And tell me about that.
Yeah, so I got to the point, you know, we're still struggling with food to eat, places to stay, all that, and the stepdads. I just started really feeling like, you know, there was really nothing in life for me. I mean, I had dreams of one. I wanted to be a veterinarian and a rock star at night, evidently. But anyways, this is kind of what I wanted, but it seemed so out of reach. So I was a depressed kid. So I started just doing drugs and alcohol and everything. And
you're how old when this is starting?
Well, the first time I ever did any drug at all was actually an aunt of mine. She actually smoked a joint with me when I was 7 years old, which is pretty crazy.
Yeah.
And she went on to become a psychologist. It's really strange to me, but
strange,
you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Anyways, so it just kind of all started there, you know, and it was a way to try to think I was covering things up. But actually with drugs and alcohol, you're just amplifying the problems you already have. It's just dulling it a little bit for the moment, but you're still dealing with all that. So I just came to the point when I became like 13, 14 years old, it was more like I was self-destructing myself. And didn't even realize, I didn't think about, I want to take my life. No, it was more I was doing that without even thinking about it. And so, you know, drugs, alcohol, girlfriends and everything, everything trying to fit that hole, that space in my heart that really only belongs to one, as we know now, right? But there I was just trying to put everything into it, you know? And I figured that the world hated me, so I was going to pay them back. and just took anything I wanted, did all the drugs, no alcohol I wanted. And it seemed to be the more people you know that do that lifestyle, you don't even have to pay for it anymore.
Huh.
So that's even worse than that, because now all this drugs and alcohol and stuff like that are free around. So, of course, you end up doing more of it. Why? Because you didn't work for it. It's just like anything, you know. If you don't work for it, you don't earn it, you don't really, you know, you don't really care. You're just going to use it up.
Now, I know later on, and we'll get to this, you had some more significant trouble with the law. But when was your first brush with the criminal justice system, with, yeah, that kind of getting in trouble with the authorities, so to speak?
Yeah. So the first time I actually got in trouble with cops and so forth is had a friend of mine that came over, and we was drinking and everything, and he asked me, he says, "Hey, you want to go break in this place?" And he starts telling me about this place we want to go break into. And he didn't tell me right off the scoop that this was a Catholic church with a school hooked onto it. But we started bringing about drum sets and so forth. Of course, I love music, and so I was like, okay, we're there. Next thing you know, we're there, and I didn't know that they already did the B&E on the place the night before.
Mm.
So one thing when you're off in that lifestyle, you never go back to the same place twice, because your probability of getting caught is much greater. So, but they did not get caught by the cops that night, but because I didn't want to trade him a snare drum for one of the tom-toms off the set I had, he ratted us out. So, you know, so I end up getting there. Well, first, they surrounded our whole apartment building. We lived above this hobby shop. And so we're just sitting up there, and I'm just kind of wondering, how long is the cops going to sit down there before they come up? We're just, you know, teenagers. But evidently, they thought it was bigger than it was, like a gang and stuff like that. So finally, they came in, they broke the door down, they put us all out in the hallway, handcuffs on, down on our knees and everything, and arrested us, and went to a youth home. And didn't do very good there. So, but finally, I was able to go to a treatment program. They had hooked on the youth home, and you get passes, and on them passes home, I would go back to the same stupid stuff I was doing before.
And did you even second guess it? Like, was there a sense of, I don't know if I should or shouldn't, having gone through the program that you were going through, or was it just immediate, you went right back to what you had been doing?
Well, that's the amazing thing, because he had this guy named Todd, and I didn't know him from Adam, but one time walking down the street, and it's the middle of winter time, and going over to my cousin's house, my guitar and everything, and Todd and these other kids, they stop me and start telling me about Jesus. He gives me a track, and I just throw that in my guitar case and stuff like that. I didn't think anything about it. But when I was in a youth home, they came in one weekend, and it was the same guy, Todd, was there. So I don't think it was any kind of coincidence. And then kind of finally, he also knew my uncle, went to school with my uncle and everything. And so he started telling me about Jesus and all that. And I accepted Jesus at that time. But I couldn't read very well. He gave me a Bible, and the pages felt like silk to me or something. I wanted to change, but I didn't know how.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's nobody there to disciple me or anything like that. And of course, I'm not going to let everybody around me know, hey, I got touched by Jesus.
Yeah.
No, I wasn't going to do that, you know, because I had an image to carry, you know.
And how old are you at this time? I know you said a teenager, but do you remember how old?
So I was about 15 years old.
Okay.
So as times went by, and I was in that youth home for about, I think, about a year and a half or so, and they end up sending me from there to another facility called Pioneer Work and Learn. Work and Learn, capital, ran by ex-Marines and everything. So,
oh, wow. So
yeah, I had
some serious work.
I had very long hair down to my waist, but when you go in that program, they shave your hair basically bald. So I had a real bad attitude about all that kind of stuff, but I really started changing there as far as working and wanted to change and so forth. Of course, they didn't have church and all that kind of stuff there, but I had a sense that I needed to do something different. But again, I ended up being a pastor from there, and I ran. And when shortly after that, a couple years after that or so, I ended up getting a case for assault attempt, you know, great bodily harm, less than murder. Guy pulled a baseball bat on my, you know, with my cousins, and the fight ended up taking the baseball bat away from him and beat him with a baseball bat. And then I ran and ran from the cops for a while, and then they finally, you know, they caught me. My aunt turned me in, and so I went to jail for that. And
how long did you serve for that?
That was I was only there about 30 days,
okay.
And I prayed to God. Didn't know much about prayers like that, but I just prayed. I made that deal, you know, people want to make. Lord, get me out of here, and I follow you for the rest of my life. I promise with everything I got, you know. And so, sure enough, the next day, they come and told me I had a plea bargain, and so I was getting out that day. Probably about an hour after I got out, I had a joint in one hand and a bottle of beer in the other, and off I'm running. And less than a year later, I'm going to prison with a murder case.
Wow. So yeah. This is the deal with God. You didn't hold up
your
kind of end of the agreement here. So
yeah, it kind of fell through kind of hard.
Yeah. So tell us, tell me about what led to getting a murder conviction. That's obviously a huge deal. And
yeah.
I know that there was one particular night that led to that, but yeah. Maybe to the extent you feel comfortable, you could tell us about that.
Well, one major thing is this right here, 30 seconds can change your life and hundreds of people's for the rest of their lives. And no doubt about that. It doesn't take much. So me and my girlfriend at the time, we had a daughter together. And so we was split up because she caught me with another girl and everything. And so, and my stupid mind, you know, strung out on drugs and everything, I'm thinking, okay, I'll throw her a birthday party. And then it'll all be good. You know what I mean? I'll be back in the car again.
Yeah.
All right. This is really stupid. So, you know, throw this birthday party for her, and everybody's left, and I'm still up there, still out of my mind. And I hear, you know, a bunch of, you know, ruckus downstairs. We lived on the second floor. Looked out there, and I seen my cousin, his girlfriend, and my girlfriend. And I see him hitting his girlfriend. You know, she's 5 months pregnant at the time. Well, about five and a half months. So I go down there, and see, over time, once I was in jail, it took a while for this kind of stuff to come back to me. Kind of, sometimes it was through dreams and everything, because I was so messed up that night, I couldn't remember the next morning. But anyway, so I remember going down there, and she said to me, Make him stop. And I'm figuring, well, I can, you know, he's my cousin, I can make him stop. We're like brothers and everything. And so this me trying to make him stop, we end up getting in a fight. And I didn't even realize there was a knife even involved until the next morning when I woke up in the county jail. And so the crazy thing was, the girls took off, I guess, before a knife even came out. So they'd never even seen a knife or anything, right? And they found a knife 15 foot away from the incident and everything. And I kept them alive until the cops got there. They said, so I woke up next morning and I'm like, you know, why am I here? And when they told me, it was like, it's like somebody dropped a building on me. You know, here I am sitting here. And at that time, I didn't know about if my cousin was dead or alive. Found out later on, for like 45 minutes, he was running his blood through tubes to try to get the alcohol out of his system. And he passed away. So when they first arrested me, and first arraignment was I think it was assault, some kind of assault. And then later on, they brought me back again for open murder. Mm. Which means they can give you anything like first degree, second degree, manslaughter, whatever it's going to be. It just opens the door for everything. So, and so that was just really crazy to me. And they come to find out the detective that was working on the case was actually a drug narcotics officer. It's been following me around for selling pounds of weed and stuff. So he's telling me he's going to get me for that or this. It doesn't matter. I'm going down for whatever it's going to be, but I'm going down. Mm. And
What ended up being the conviction then?
Well, so over time, they brought different plea bargains. It's cheaper to, for the county to plea bargain than you go to trial, especially when you have a court-appointed attorney. So finally, they came with a second degree. So I got sentenced to 17 to 50 years in prison. So,
wow. What did it feel like when they actually announced that? I mean, you already had to go through the waking up the next day and finding out your cousin was, you're in jail, and you find out your cousin is passed now, and, you're, and you had a role in that. But this is probably some weeks later. Mm-hmm. Was it months later or weeks later that this whole process is taking out?
It's months later.
Months later. And they say those words, as far as your sentence is concerned. What's it feel like to hear that?
Yeah, well, it was kind of crazy because it wasn't just the sentence and lose my cousin, but I'm also going through a custody battle for my daughter at the time too. And then a judge telling me, well, if you beat this case, you get out, we're going to warrant you custody over my girlfriend. So everything is on the line here, you know. And but at the same time, I'm feeling like, you know, my cousin's life, they're saying I took it, and so I deserve anything. I deserve to die. That's the way I looked at it, you know. And probably could have went to trial and could have beat the case according to evidence, but I didn't think I deserved that, you know. So at that point, I was to the point where I guess I'm not worthy of nothing to nobody. So I took the plea bargain.
Okay.
And so I was only in the county jail after taking the plea bargain. 3 days later, they take me out. But altogether, I was in the county jail for 2 years because they wanted to wait until I turned 21. Because I turned 21, now they can send me behind the walls of Jackson, which is the worst place to go in Michigan. So that's going with all the serial killers, rapists, and everything else. So it's a pretty bad place. Always yelling, people starting the mattresses on fire, they throw feces and everything else. It's just, I remember sitting there.
So when they moved you to Jackson, you're 21 years old?
21 years old, yeah.
So you're 21, you walk into Jackson, are you with a group of guys that, you know, I've not seen this kind of thing happen other than in the movies when you see guys kind of all walking out of the van, you know, in a line. Is that how it works, or how does it work?
Well, that's how it works for some, but for me, they drove me there by myself.
Okay.
So they looked at me as one of the most dangerous people at the time in Monroe County. That year was the bloodiest year ever in Monroe history. It was six murders. Mm. So they looked at me a little different when it comes to that. So I had the belly chains, and there's a black box that goes around your hands. You can't move or you can't stand up straight like that. So they took me by myself. And so when you get there, I mean, it's like it's humiliation because they strip you down and they spray you with hoses and putting this really bad smelling soap on you, disinfectant stuff. And so you really start feeling like that subhuman. Mm-hmm. And that's how you feel the whole time you're in prison. You're a number. Your name doesn't matter no more. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's all you become is just a number.
Did you, when you got there, I'm certainly you'd heard probably stories about Jackson up to that point and more of a reputation.
Yeah.
Was the experience you had from the day one being in Jackson, was it as bad as you had heard and expected? Or was that something, some of the stories you were telling, were those over time and, you know, you really discovered how bad it was? Or was it like, no, day one, this is truly terrible?
Oh, this is truly terrible.
Yeah.
I remember I happened to see a guy I knew growing up. And so I had him, he run me a couple of shanks, some homemade knives that you make in there. And there, a lot of times, the Bible will save your soul, but also save your flesh in there. Because you make like these vests made of the Bibles, and you actually wear them up over your clothes. So if I stick you with a shank, it's not going to go in as far enough to take your life. So that kind of stuff. So I used to carry two shanks when I first got there on both sides down in my pants. Thank God I never had to use it. But you just kind of, when you're in that situation, you're, and I was, I accepted Christ before I went to prison, but I was still young and still was trying to learn how God was going to really protect me. Mm-hmm. I was still learning about that. And, you know, through my time in a joint, he showed it. I mean, showed out. Yeah.
Yeah. How'd that look? So you're getting there. You've got your plan to protect yourself from potential harm that could come your way. You've already got a relationship with Christ, but you've already talked about how, you know, there's been some spiritual distance there from really following Jesus all in, and you haven't really been discipled. What did your spiritual journey look like while you were in Jackson? How did that play out?
Well, you know, you spend a lot of time yourself, and I didn't have a TV.
Did you have a roommate or not?
No.
Like a cellmate?
These are all singles. This is level five, so in level five, you don't have a roommate at okay. all. So you're all by yourself. So you really only come out for your meal times, and you come out for like an hour and a half of yard. That's it. And a lot of times I wouldn't go out to the yard because there's really nothing out there for me anyways, you know. And so a lot of my time was actually in the Bible. And that's a wild thing too, because, you know, I could not read before I went there. So to go backwards, I was in the county jail, and when I accepted Christ, everything come down to me, and I prayed, and I says, "There's something here I really need to know, and I know I need to know. Just show me somehow." And I cried myself to sleep, and that's the first time I cried since I was 9 years old when my dad died. And I just remember just throwing the blanket over my head and like, you know, either take me and show me this or just let me die, you know. And next morning I just woke up and things were totally different. And as I'm looking through the Bible, I'm not realizing even at that time how God has really opened these words up to me. And I'm starting to read it and understand it and so forth. And so I asked about going up to, school, you know.
This is now back to Jackson?
This is still in jail.
In jail,
and
okay.
I'm asking about going to school, and it took a while, and you got what they call kites. You can write these little, it's like a little paper or something. You got to, like, write your little notes here, your name and all that, and you kind of turn it in. I sent that to the warden of the county jail, and they finally allowed me to go to a GD class, and so they give you a test first, and they have your file from school and everything. And I passed 12.9 plus in my reading and comprehension. And how was that possible after a year when my reading level was like, I think it was like third or fourth grade reading level? So the teacher was blown away by that. She mm-hmm. says, "How did you do this?" I was like, "I pulled my Bible out of my pocket." I said, "This is how I did it right here."
Wow. So you basically jumped from a reading assessment level from third grade
yeah.
to 12th grade reading level
yeah.
just by sitting there and doing your best to work through the Bible. When you were reading it, did it feel like—
It was a King James too.
Yes. So no wonder your reading level went up so high,
yeah.
making you work for it.
Yeah.
Did you feel like as you were reading it, you could tell, I'm reading this better over time? Or was it just like you just felt like your eyes were opened very early on and it just was consistent then?
This felt like we're talking right here. It's mm-hmm. like God was talking to me as I'm reading this. I'm not even comprehending that my reading level is getting better. I'm reading this better and better every day. That's not even coming to mind. It's just something I had to have.
Okay.
I mean, it was like the best tasted thing in my life. I had to have. I was driven to it. It was, you know, there was nothing else that mattered.
So back to Jackson. I think you were saying you're alone for nearly all the day, minus meal
yeah.
times and some outside time, which you usually took a pass on. So you're just sitting there reading the Bible all the time, essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah. When did you start to, up till now, you've kind of made some deals with God, you had a relationship with him. When did you feel like something is shifting as far as your relationship with God and things were changing?
Well, it's like, many things happen, but God didn't have to do to prove to me, because I could feel the love. I mean, I was overflowed with it. I could feel that there was a change, like it was dynamic change mm-hmm. that took place. But he would put even people on my path that some people might not even think about. I remember I was in the quarantine quarantine is someplace you go when you first go to prison. They put you there so they figure out where they're going to send you. So they go through all kinds of tests and so forth. So I'm sitting there, and I'm up in the top six part of this, where they usually send people who they consider to be dangerous or escape risk. Because I had so many escapes through juvenile detention that all affected me in prison, too, just before I even got there. Mm-hmm. So I'm sitting up there, and I'm still smoking cigarettes and so forth. And in fact, I'm chain smoking, and you got to roll these things up, you know, buglers. And you got a guy next door, in the cell next door, and I hear him talking all the time. You can't, it's kind of muffled. I'm just thinking he's crazy or mm-hmm. something, right? One day he reaches around, because you reach around your bars there, and he hands me a piece of paper. And I'm like, okay, this might be one of them kind of guys that think that I'm sweet or something. You know? Mm-hmm. I'm not going for it.
Yeah.
You know? So anyways, I open it up in the scriptures. And so I grab my Bible and I look it up, and it's talking about destroying the temple, you know. And after I read that, I took my buglers and I flushed them all down the toilet and never smoked again. And it was just things like that that God would do when I was in there. And me and that guy would fellowship every day, and he was doing, I mean, all of his life in prison. And he was only back there because he was going back for what they call a writ. I mean, he's going back to see if he can get his sentence down and so forth, right? Or he wouldn't have been there. But I don't think it's by mistake that he was there. Mm-hmm. I believe he was sent there, you know, by God to get them things out of my life.
And you guys would talk, I mean, once you connected then, because if he's close enough to touch, you guys can talk and so you started talking about scripture. Spiritual growth and scripture and stuff like that.
Yeah, so I learned a lot from him. He was kind of like my Paul. Mm-hmm. At that time, because I was really new. He's been in the Word for 25 years by that time. And so it was really nice to have somebody that you can talk to like that, because, you know, you was in a very hot, small cell there in Jackson on top six. And before him, the only friends I had was cockroaches in there, mm-hmm. for real, because they was everywhere, mm-hmm. you know. And so... as I left there, I mean, everywhere I go, it seemed like that God would show me more of what he was going to do, you know.
What was it like, considering how important that relationship was mm-hmm. for you and your story and development? What was it like when you eventually moved and you weren't next to him anymore? Was that hard or was it not a big deal?
Well, you know, I can see how important Paul was to Timothy. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so the whole time I was in, I was always I wanted somebody that could help me be a disciple, but I didn't trust everybody, because to me, I wanted to. If you come to me with the Word, I want to come straight from the Word. I don't want just your interpretation of it. I mean, line upon line, precept upon precept, that's what it was going to be. So don't come talk to me about what a TV evangelist is telling you. Tell me what the scripture's telling you, right? And that's kind of how I lived. And finally, God put upon my heart, he's like, am I not sufficient? I give you the Holy Spirit. This is the Holy Spirit teach you. You know, and so I started seeing that maybe God had something different for me. So I didn't, after that, that was the only person I had the whole time I was in that actually fed stuff like that into me. The rest of the time, it was just, you know, the scripture and God, what he was doing, and just laying everything on him and making him my all.
Wow.
Surrendering everything to him. So
amazing. Now, I recall from talking with you previously, did you get some unique opportunities while you were still in prison as far as education and whatnot? Tell me about those. So at some point, they moved you from that solitary situation mm-hmm. someplace else, and then you started getting more opportunities and whatnot. Tell us about that journey.
Yeah, so the crazy thing about that is my brother, which he wasn't even a Christian, but when I was in the county jail, he signed me up for a Bible study. This was something I do through the mail. So I did. And so through that, I met this, you know, this lady who was my instructor. Later on, she started sending me pictures of her family and everything, and we really started getting a good rapport. And so after I got done with this Bible study, I had an opportunity to do Kuiper College. and a scholarship through there. So I ended up doing that through the mail, and I loved it so much because it was, I know, I always liked learning new things, even though I couldn't read that good back when I was a youth, but to learn something new, and now I was learning something I was really passionate about. So it was an opportunity. So topical studies was very important to me. And when you go to college and everything like that, with Bible college, there's a lot of topical studies and history, and I love that kind of stuff. So after I graduated from that, I still wanted more. And I ended up meeting another guy, and he told me about the college that he was doing. So I wrote an essay for that college, Reed School of the Bible. And it was a chance to get another, just was an associate degree and to religious education, which I was a little leery about at first, because now I know I'm going to have to do some Hebrew and some Greek. And I tried to do Spanish when I was younger. I just can't roll the tongue, you know.
You and me are in the same boat. I did Spanish when I was younger, and then when I got to seminary, it was Greek and Hebrew time. And yeah. I'll tell you what, I made an art of struggling.
I found the Hebrew to be easier than the Greek.
They say that people always fall off one or the other. Either you favor Greek or you favor Hebrew. Yeah. I was more Greek because it felt like it overlapped a little bit more with English, and right. Hebrew is a very different language than Greek or English. And so I found Greek easier. That's interesting. I don't actually meet many people that go, they clicked more with Hebrew. So that was you though, huh? Wow.
I don't know what it was. It was just, I guess, the more guttural sounds are not hard for me.
Yeah, yeah.
But some of the other, especially when it came to, the writing it down, I found Hebrew, which is kind of weird because I draw too. Mm-hmm. So you think, Greek is kind of more, got more design to it. It'd be something I'd be more into, but for some reason it was a little bit harder to do.
Interesting. Interesting. So you've got two of those programs. Now, did Jackson have sometimes some prisons, and I don't know if Jackson is the case for this, they'll have, if they see that you're making progress, if they see that you've had good behavior, if they see that it seems like there's a legitimate spiritual change that's happening, they'll let you have corporate worship opportunities or other kind of religious education experiences with other guys and all that. Did you get any of that, or was this all solo for you?
Well, it wasn't, Jackson and the Four Black, I do not remember us going to actually have a church, but we did start one actually on the yard, which is dangerous.
Okay.
Because when you're a Christian and the joint here in Michigan, majority of the joint is ran by Muslims. Okay, so just like any place else, different countries and so forth, of course, they don't like Christians. They rather them off be dead. And so in prison, it's more gang associated also. It's not so much into a religious type of thing. It's more of a religious gang. So when you step out and say you're a follower of Christ, you're basically putting a mark on yourself. Either they're going to try to tempt you to try to make you into a sexual favor or something like that, or if they don't feel they can go that way, they're going to try to rob you or so forth, right? But God seemed to protect me from all that kind of stuff, and I was always bold with it too, I believe as John the Baptist can be as bold as he was, mm-hmm. I'm going to do the same. Mm-hmm. And so even when I got death threats on my bed from ministering to Muslims and leading them to Christ, and so their brothers would start putting death threats on my bed, he's going to try to take me out, I would stand at my bar, my Bible open, and preach out loud to everybody. Mm-hmm. And they might have seen it as crazy. I didn't matter. To me, it was like, I'm just going to stand bold on this. And this is I know this is life, and then I know everybody needs to know it.
Wow.
How
long did you end up serving in total, Dennis?
I ended up serving 19 and a half years.
Wow.
Went to the parole board three times.
Is that right? Okay, 19 and a half years.
Yeah.
So eventually now you get out, you've got not one but two degrees, or I don't know if the other one was a certification or degree proper. Well, you said associates, yeah, and then Kuiper's, was that an associate's or bachelor's?
That was a certificate,
okay.
Yeah.
So you've got this education, you get out. What did it feel like to walk out into freedom for the first time after being away for 19 and a half years?
Well, that was a lot of wake-up call. So I remember when I was sitting there and I was waiting, I was trying to wait to get out, and they was letting everybody out in front of me. So I'm sitting there waiting, and then come to find out my dress all clothes, they didn't have dress all clothes for me, right?
What's that, dress all clothes, as you're saying?
Yeah, so they got these clothes they give you if you don't have your own personal clothes delivered to you for you to go home in. They give you these clothes, and they're like tan outfit, you know?
Okay.
It's, you know, they're pretty ugly. So, but they didn't have a pair for me. So I'm like, okay. So Satan started trying to put something on mine. They changed their mind. They're not going to let you out. You know, and I said, I'm not going to believe that, you know. So I started quoting scripture to them, you know, and sure enough, they finally let me go. And so I remember my friends, the ones from Bible study, is actually ones who took me into their own home. They had to give all of their guns up for hunting and stuff because I can't be in a house with a gun. And so they gave all that kind of stuff up, and here I am, a guy who was in prison for murder and everything, and they have a daughter who's a parole agent, which comes into Michigan to visit me. She lives in California. that was kind of interesting. So anyways, so here I sit, and they're asking me, well, you want to take one more look back to the prison before you leave? I'm like, I don't want to turn to salt. Let's get up out of here.
Yeah, you know, right.
Ain't no way I'm doing that.
I think 19 and a half years of looking at it's probably does the trick, yeah.
And so I remember when they first handed me a cell phone. I didn't know what a cell phone was, except for what I saw on TV, you know. I didn't know how to use it. So I had them, you know, dial my mom and everything like that and talk to her on the phone. And it was just a real interesting thing to me. Before, I think it was like the next day, they took me into a Walmart. And
who's they when you're saying they?
Their name is Pete and Judy. They took me in.
The ones who took you in are the ones taking the Walmart.
They became like mom to dad to me.
Okay.
There's more parents than I ever had. They made everything to me, you know. And so basically it was like, get what you need, you know. And I got overwhelmed. And I ran out of Walmart. And I'm outside and I could hardly breathe. I had a panic attack. I didn't know what a panic attack even was like that. But, yeah, it was too much.
Had they done anything in prison prior to your release to get you ready for? I just think about the massive shock to the system it would be to go out freedom by itself, let alone a world that's 19 and a half years different. Yeah. Do they do anything to try to train? I mean, probably there's nothing they can do to fully prepare you, but to get you ready for that level of transition?
Well, that's the shame about the way things are ran is, to me, they need to have something like that set up. So there is things you can sign up for to learn about, like resumes and stuff like that. But as far as to be actually ready, they really not. If you don't have people to go to and you end up getting a parole, you get, you know, your $75 bus ticket, and they give you this little packet, and this little packet, there's contraceptive in there, which I disagree with, because that's the guy's downfall to come back.
Right.
To get into a relationship, and they end up going back, right? But they don't really give you any tools to make it. And what I think they really need to do is they need to be a support group for when they do get out. People are actually going to be there 100%. And this is where, in my opinion, the church could step up and do something like that, right? Okay, these people messed up. They did some bad stuff. But I really had somebody reformed living next to me and somebody who's not. Mm-hmm. So that's what we really need to think about, right? So I think if they had a program where churches stepped up and say, okay, we're going to take this one, and he's got like four or five people assigned to him to check up on him, see how he's doing this and that would change everything.
Are you aware of in Holland or Grand Rapids, any kind of, I know there's the Ministry 70 times 7, you might be familiar with it, but are you aware of any programs that are helping the formerly incarcerated to adjust back into society? Obviously, you got out quite a while ago. Yeah. What year is that you got out? Do you recall?
I got out in 2009.
2009, yes. Yeah. It's a number of years ago. Do you know of anything locally that where they're helping out?
Well, I know at Gateway Mission, we have taken and people get who are on parole and so forth to help out with that. But on a big scale of things, I don't know of anything around like that. They really should be. And a lot of times that kind of program would need funding. And so a lot of, in politics, a lot of people are probably not really thinking that's that important. Mm-hmm. What prison become is more like a cattle ranch, really. And that's why we have such a gigantic turnback rate.
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem.
Which continues to be the case today nationwide, the number of folks that come back. And my brother-in-law serves in juvenile justice mm-hmm. with Youth for Christ. And so he walks with kids who are in the system while they're in there and then tries to track with them once they get out. But man, even with those level of supports, it's still sad to see how many kids go back. Yeah. And part of it's because they're often going back to the same toxic and broken environments that are reinforcing the kinds of lifestyles and decisions that got them in the first place. So you get out. Fortunately, you're blessed to have this couple in your life who is giving you a place to land, and sounds like they were a healthy couple. You started, I know, looking for jobs, and that's another thing that the formerly incarcerated, that becomes a major challenge. Mm-hmm. Tell me about your job journey and then what led you ultimately to Gateway.
Yeah, so it was a little different about my situation. Not everybody gets out with the mindset I had. I got the mindset there was no plan B, and it was only the plan that God had. So when I got out and started looking for jobs, of course, my friends, Judy and Pete, they wanted to like drive me to jobs, this and that, put in applications. I said no. I says, if I'm going to have to work 8 hours a day for a job, I'm going to walk 8 hours a day to find a job. And at the time I got out, the economy was crashed. You know, it wasn't in good shape. So I remember going to places like McDonald's and putting an application in there and sitting next to people who was real estate at one time. Now they're trying to get a job at McDonald's. So it was pretty crazy. Mm-hmm. And I remember walking in the snow and I'm wet and everything else, you know. But even in that, God, you know, I'd go put in for a job and somebody would bless me with a hot chocolate or frozen yogurt or something like that, someplace I put in for. And then was little things that might be something with somebody, but I was taking them as, you know, God was just blessing me along my journey, you know. And then finally I walked to this place. They sold slices of pizza. And I figured, well, I'll go get me a slice of pizza. And I saw on the window that they was hiring. And I've always loved to cook and everything. So I went in there and I figured I'm going to tell them right off the bat who I am, what I've been through. I'm on parole. I'm going to let them know everything because I figured, well, why hide it and they find out later on that I'm in trouble? Also, I believe if I tell the truth, that's a testimony God has in my life. So that's what I'm going to do. So when I started talking to George, which was the owner, he was like, can you stay here a little bit longer? I was like, why? He's like, I want to call my wife. I want my wife to come in. Can you tell her the same story you just told me? And so I did. And they stood up and they both hugged me. And they said, you're hired. And you'd be such a blessing to our restaurant, you know.
Wow.
And so I would take the order or the pizza over the phone, make the pizza and deliver sometimes, you know. So I get double tips.
That's great.
You know? So yeah. There we go. But That was a stepping stone there. And then with the, you know, the Vanderarks was their name, the, you know, Pete and Judy I lived with, they had a friend that I met through their ministry, and I ended up painting, he owned a used car dealership, so I ended up painting his lobby and everything when he found out I could paint. And he was so impressed about it. He shared it with his, I think it was his cousin, and he hired me as painting company.
Oh, wow.
Which is now one of the biggest painting companies in West Michigan, you know. Huh. And so I was making decent money with him and everything, and I was loving it. He used to call me the finisher because I would purposely go in there and I would paint until I couldn't paint no more. And I figured, well, the person next to me, I feel I needed to always do better than he did. Because why? I was an ex-felon. Mm-hmm. And I was not going to let that hang me down as far as a job. So I kept on getting raises because I worked the next guy next to me. And so as that you know, goes on from there, I am getting laid off from that job because wintertime work slows down, this and that. And this happened to be on Craigslist. And I found a job at a company called Hex Armor. And I remember first going to this place. And, you know, I sold when I was in prison in a garment factory in there. And so I go there and I do the test and all that kind of stuff. But when I went back in there, I was the only white person I seen, except for the guy that walked me in there, you know. So at first it looked like a sweatshop or something to me. I mean, it was a little different, you know. And because hardly anybody spoke English and everything, but I ended up getting a job there. And it was a lot less money, but I worked my way up and I worked hard. And it was a little discouraging because it seemed that at first they didn't see how hard a person was working, you know. And so it was a little discouraging to me. But I started getting good rapport with some of the bosses and started explaining to them how important it was for the big people to come down to the production floor and get to know people. And it's going to make a difference, you know, community. If you want your company to grow, that's the kind of stuff you got to do. You can't stay up here, they're down here.
How'd you end up at Gateway then? I know that you were making some calls at one point and getting a lot of turndowns, but then they called back and said, hey, we got a job for you.
So after being at Heck Summer for 7.5 years, I gave up looking for a job for a while. But then one day I'm sitting at lunch and I'm going to a job at Deed and I seen this job and I'm like, okay, I'll pray about this and I'll put in for a ministry one more time because I kept on getting turned down all the time because of the felonies, you know. And I thought for sure when I got out of prison, I had a degree that, okay, I'm going to be assuring somewhere. Nope. So I ended up calling there and put the application in through Job of Deed and all that. And I'm driving home later that day, and I got a call from the HR there, and her voice sounded like Angel to me, man. I ain't playing. And it was right away when I first started hearing a voice, I just felt like I was going to sob, you know. And she started talking about how much she was impressed with my testimony. This is the first place I ever actually sent a copy of my testimony to, too, along with the application and everything. Wow. So she asked if I can come for an interview. It was literally the next day. And I was like, well, let me talk to my wife and everything. And went home and told my wife about it, and I was just so shook up. And so, you know, went for an interview, and it was awesome. So they wanted to interview me again. I got interviewed, I think, about 4 or 5 people all together. So I think since I've been there, it's the most I've ever seen somebody get interviewed by some people. Anyway, so that was kind of interesting.
Once they read your testimony, they're like, you know what? Let's have a few conversations with this guy.
Right. And the job I put in for is not the job I ended up getting. They actually made a job for me. So with the second interview, they had a new job to offer me. It was better pay and everything. And better opportunity, you know.
How have you seen... You've got, when I've been there, you've got folks that are part of the program for different reasons, different backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And part of what's cool about you being in a leadership role now as production manager is you've got the story you have and you're in a leadership role. Mm-hmm. How have you seen God use what you've been through in your leadership role with some of the folks coming through the different programs and ministries of Gateway?
Well, here's the main thing I think about any kind of program like this when it comes to people getting off drugs, alcohol, homeless, and that. The more people you have in place that's been through similar things, the better opportunity there is because, you know, I can learn a lot of things from a book, which is great. I'm not getting down on that. But when you have experience, that person can, it opens a door. So if I'm sitting in front of somebody who's an ex-addict and I'm talking to them and I explain my story to them too, now they feel more comfortable. I've walked in their shoes. So now they can open up and they feel more trust that way, right? So this is what I've tried to do since I've been there. So when a new student comes in, I always try to sit down with them and I give them a copy of my testimony and I want to hear about them too, but I also explain to them that I'm here for them. And I don't, you know, it's all about work. We got to make the work to make the money, but regardless of that, ministry is first, in my opinion. So I let them know, if you have a rough day, I don't want you giving up. Come and talk to me. We'll talk for a while and would talk, whatever we talk about, it stays between us, unless you're going to harm somebody else or yourself. That's a little different. But other than that, we could talk, you know, I don't want you to jump off the ledge. Mm-hmm. And I got to that point in my life because I had friends that I didn't see it was about to kill ourselves. And I should have seen. And I did. And I lost them. I don't want to have that happen again.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I have had...
Yeah, and you've said, I remember being there, and you said you've had a certain number of people that, not necessarily, I don't know if while they were there, but maybe, I can't remember now, that you've seen OD or have something else that happened to them. And you could tell as you were sharing with me, it weighed on you. Do you remember that comment I'm referring to?
Yeah, so it's just, we've had a few, and I can't remember the numbers, but sometimes, you might hear like a month later that somebody who was one of the students, then they decided to leave. They're dead in a hotel room, you know. We've had people that passed from cancer and stuff like that, and you become really close to them, you know. And I don't consider them just, you know, they call them students. When they're working for me, I consider them employees. But even more than that, you get invested in their lives, you know. And of course, there's boundaries you got to keep, okay. But at the same time, you really care about them. And you know, my wife could tell you this. You know, I'm at home. I can't shut it off. I'm still thinking about it. I'm thinking about process to make it better. I'm thinking about people that need prayer, what they're going through, this and that, you know, and how important it is that we don't miss the mark. Because sometimes there's so many people that work at there or any other ministry, and somebody's going through something, and they can just slide through the gaps, and we need to tighten the gaps up.
Yeah. You know? Well, that was walking through and seeing the rapport you had with the different folks who are working was really, really cool. And just hearing all of the different ways that you have made improvements to the processes at the Gateway Center. Oh, we, you know, I figured this out, or we said we could save money by doing this over here. And, mm-hmm. and your overall just grasp of all the numbers. It's so cool to see your dashboard on, this is our goal, this is where we're at, this is what we did last year. Mm-hmm. And I was just, you've really got an amazing balance of, you've got this story of the places you've been, you've got this leadership mind that you're paying attention to how the operation is run, how can we do better? I forget, I mean, some of the changes you've made have saved tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars, as I recall you sharing with me. And then you've got this pastoral heart that wants to walk with people and really truly cares about the people you're serving. And I just, man, I was absolutely inspired by that. Just watching you work and interact. I realized as we were talking, you mentioned something that we didn't cover this whole time, which is you're now married and have kids.
Yes.
So
I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah.
Because she might get a little upset if she's not brought up.
So how does that happen? I mean, you know, I just can't, like, you've served time with a murder conviction. And I've haven't asked you this question before, even how the backstory of your relationship, because that's it's like, what's that first date like? And so tell me, how did you guys meet? What happened?
Well, that's kind of wild too. My brother comes in play again.
Okay.
He doesn't know how many times God's used him. He needs to go ahead and lay it down to him. I ain't playing.
Yeah.
So anyways, so I go to my brother's house for Thanksgiving, and I'm still on parole at this time and so forth. So he lives way over in Marysville. And which was the longest drive I did at that time since I've been out, you know. And so I'm there, and he starts talking about all these dates he's going on through this website. And I was like, I am not interested in that. I'm still even learning about internet and all that kind of stuff. You know what I mean?
You're using a cell phone now, so that's a good step.
Yeah, but by this time I had like a little HP Mini, you know, I got for Christmas, you know. But I was like, I wasn't really interested in all that because, you know, I just heard crazy stuff about that stuff, right? So before the time's over there, he finally cons me into go ahead and getting on there. He does the profile. He takes a picture of me. I'm not thinking anything of it. I drive home, and by the time I get home, I got 75 hits. Like 2 hours, about 2 hours and 15 minutes or whatever, right? I'm like, this is insane.
Yeah.
So I was like, well, well, I'm not going to college, I'm not trying to flip this house, man, I got a little bit of time, so I'll go ahead and maybe I'll go on a date, and I'll take them to Big B's because buying them a coffee is cheaper than buying a meal.
Right.
You know, I grew up dirt poor, so I don't like spending money.
Yeah.
So anyways, so I started going on these dates and everything, and so I go on 25, different dates, you know, and tell you, it was, if I ever decided to retire, I'm going to do some stand-up comedy.
From all those dates?
Yeah, it's going to be hilarious.
But yeah.
Anyways, so finally, I ended up going on this one date, and I went on the second one with her. The first date was good. I went on the second one, and this is not my wife we're talking about. So I go roller skating, and a kid goes in front of me. I go down and busted my arm up. And so I ended up having surgery and everything on my arm, the ulnar nerve, which is what they call the funny bone. It's actually a nerve. It controls your arm. And let me tell you, that's a bad deal if you get messed that thing up. So anyways, I'm sitting there, and they got me on really strong meds and everything. And I'm just bored up in my room because I'm so out of my mind with these meds they got me on. I can't even go downstairs to get something to eat. And so my computer's there, and so go back on there, and I was like, well, I'll just scroll through. And I scroll through, and I see my wife's profile, and it's full of scriptures and everything, you know, and I'm like, this is interesting. I think I'm going to go ahead and pray about this, and I prayed about it, and I went ahead and sent her a message. And another thing, interesting about that was I've never dated anybody with short hair. And her hair just wasn't short. It was like,
short.
Okay. You know? So that was a little bit different for me. And so we started just corresponding back and forth. I mean, like crazy. I mean, like long emails and everything. And then we start talking on the phone and start talking to her about, the pastor at the church I was going to, he was leaving. And that was going to be a little bit different because, it was a Reformed church, but it really didn't feel like a Reformed church because he was a little bit more Reformed charismatic mixture. It sounds kind of crazy, I know, but it was working. So anyways, I said, well, I'm thinking about trying to look around, see if I could find a different church. She starts telling me about Grammar's First, the church that she was going to.
Yeah,
and I was
sure.
Like, she's like, we should check it out sometime. I was like, oh, well, how about this Sunday? And I guess that threw her back.
So you guys have not met in person yet?
Haven't even met in person yet.
Okay, gotcha.
She's kind of really thrown back by that. It's a little quick for her. And I'm like, I'm not even thinking about that. I'm like, and she's like, oh,
okay. The question everybody's wondering right now is, I'm assuming at this point she does or does not know about all your past.
She does not know.
Does not know. Okay.
She has no idea.
Been having good conversations about the Bible, all this other stuff.
Right.
You say, let's meet at church. Yep. She has no idea about all the colorful stuff.
So as soon as we get there, and I look at her, and she kind of reminded me a little bit of like Pat Benatar type of look at the time there. And I was like, oh, this is working.
We'll have to link to Pat Benatar in our show notes because half the people are like, who is that? So we'll make sure we got a picture. Yeah. That's a good reference. Yeah.
Yeah. But it was kind of different because it had a lady playing a big old piano. It really didn't go along with that thought in my mind. But So we went and we sat down and we had small talk at first, and then I started just laying it down. We're right there in church. You know, you ain't got a whole lot of time before praise and worship come on this net. So this is like I'm jamming this stuff at her real quick. But then her friend walks up and kind of cuts in. So she only gets part of the information. And during the time I'm sitting there, I think about just reaching over, holding her hand, which is kind of weird. You just met this girl and you got to do that.
Right.
Which I didn't do that, but
probably a good call.
But I felt like I wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, I found out that she felt the same way.
Really?
Yeah. And so I go home, and we didn't get a chance to finish that conversation because church is going on and so forth. But I really liked that she raised her hands, tears come out of her eyes, this and that. And I could see that she meant what she was doing there at church, which meant a lot to me. So I called her and I says, well, you want to meet at Big B's? So we went there And I baked peanut butter cookies the night before.
Wow.
I love bacon and everything.
Romantic guy.
Yeah, well, you know, and so I brought her peanut butter cookies, and there was a whole, you know, whole container of them. And, of course, she'd eat one right then. But she didn't have much hair, but she kind of messed with her hair a little bit, and she kind of turned away. That's a sign. If anybody out there wants to know, that's a sign. That's plays with her hair, turns away a little bit, she might be into you. So, and the peanut butter cookies, I think, was the cherry
that's
on top.
That's the secret, yeah.
We still have the container at home today.
Do you really? Oh, that's so good.
And I always tell people the story every time the container comes out. It's like, that's why she married me.
That's the magic right there.
There's some cookies.
That and your cheap coffee. Yeah, yes. You got the coffee date and you got your homemade peanut butter cookies. Yeah. So when you were saying you were talking with her at church, was that a reference to like actually opening up to some of the past stuff with criminal justice stuff, all that?
Prison,
okay,
all
so
that.
You did start opening. Okay, gotcha.
Oh, yeah,
so she was
10
not.
Minutes, she got like the 10-minute version of all of that.
Woof.
So that's quite a bit.
Yeah, and then you guys follow up and say, well, let's do this coffee thing.
Yeah.
And then because you got interrupted at church. So did you get through the whole story at church?
Not the whole story. No.
So then
it got
the coffee
cut off
date.
Right in the middle.
Oh my gosh! So the coffee date was really the part two on the whole
thing. Right. We got to the part of went to prison for murder, this and that, and changed and so forth, but not all of it.
So the first song starts. Well, that's a cliffhanger.
So I'm thinking, well, maybe she's not going to contact me after this, you know? But it didn't work out that way. But 4 weeks later, I asked her to marry me.
No kidding.
Yeah. I sold my favorite guitar and amp and asked her to marry me, which is kind of wild. I sold it after I asked her, so I didn't hand her a band that night or anything like that. We were just sitting on the couch, and it just came out. I couldn't control it. And I remember leaving that night and start talking about dates, this and that automatically. And the day we picked up, it didn't click in my head until right away. That was the day I got off parole.
Is that right?
The day I would get off parole. Mm. So I didn't think about that. And as I'm leaving, I'm driving the S-curve in Grand Rapids. I lived on the north side at the time, and she lived in Wyoming. And out of nowhere, this black BMW came and almost hit me. And I spun out of control, and I had a Grand Prix at that time. Spun out of control and hit my car in the front and the back on the wall there in S-curve, and it stalled out. And as I looked like this right here, there's a semi coming. And, man, let me tell you, I'm glad that car has to get up and go, because I turned that thing on real quick and slammed it into reverse and got out of the way right in time. Mm. I've been dead that night.
Wow.
And so I just called her on the phone as I'm driving, and she's praying as I'm on the way home, all shook up. I got out of my car, and I look at my car, and I'm like, oh, I felt sick. You know, I was like, oh, this is the best car I ever had. Look at it now, you know?
What did her parents say? Do you know what her parents' reaction was? I'm guessing she was in a relationship with her parents. So, like, and she lets them know, so my boyfriend, and I don't know if they probably found the story out before you were engaged, I'm guessing. Yeah. In the first 4 weeks, she probably let them know. But do you know how they reacted?
Well, her parents didn't react bad at all. Her parents a little bit, they're a little laid back, you know, a little more laid back than I am with my daughters and stuff. But I just remember, come to find out, you know, her brother was in prison at the time too. Okay, so they have a little bit of history with the prison thing.
Yeah.
So they kind of got that a little bit. But you would think that her dad might say something, just that kind of test the waters, whatever. No, nothing like that at all.
No kidding.
Didn't experience anything like that from that side at all. Mm. And so, of course, shortly after that, I got laid off of work. I was working for the paint company at that time. I got laid off of work. So I just asked this woman to marry me. I'm getting laid off of work. How am I going to pay for this? Mm-hmm. You know? And God came out of the work there too. You know, her mom ended up giving some money towards it. My friends at Vander Arks ended up paying for the food. Another friend that I met through, the Vander Arks ministry, he volunteered to cook for us. And all the teenagers worked with, because it was a youth program we worked with, because they go on mission trips and so forth. They all became the waiters and everything.
No kidding.
You know, which meant a lot to me, because here's the kids that I'm leading praise and worship everything with. And now they're helping me out, you know, and
so
it was
cool.
Awesome. And even the wedding dress, a friend of hers sister was going to get married in a church, and they decided to get married on the beach. So she had the wedding dress, and this is brand new, never worn, and it fit my wife.
Isn't that cool? How God just comes through in such amazing and cool ways. First, thank you for sharing the story there, because I've wanted to ask that for the longest time, and just imagining that first time you share that news with her about your past, and what a crazy thing to not even get all the way through it there at church. But we eventually met in part because your connection to Engedi, and so I just walk by all the time and I see in church. And maybe the last thing we could touch on before we close today is what led you to connect with Engedi. I mean, I am asking that in part because we want to be a church, and I think any church does, that you want to be a place where folks from any background can say, I can connect here. And I just would be curious to hear your thoughts on that. Why Engedi, and how does the church do a good job saying, hey, no matter where you come from, you got a place here?
Well, that's an interesting story. So as we moved here, of course, we was trying to find a church close to here because it'd be quite a bit to drive to Grand Rapids, the Grammar's first every Sunday. We started going to different churches, and we really didn't see a real connection going on. We really wanted, you know, hands raised in praise and worship and really some sincerity, this and that. So for a while, one day I was like, well, man, let's go to the biggest church around. So we went to Central for a while, which I still love Central.
Sure.
Pastor Craig, awesome guy.
Yeah, absolutely.
I still consider him a friend and stuff like that. But then, you know, sometimes I work at the donation door to kind of help out. And there's a lot of people from Engedi that come there and donate.
Okay.
And I met a lot of people from Engedi coming through there and had good conversations. And I was like, oh, it's pretty awesome. Then one day, also Marissa, which used to work at Gateway, went here, and she used to talk about it. And one day my wife, she was like, well, let's check out Engedi. I was like, okay. Went there, and I was thrown back at first because there is a lot of young people. We go to the later service. And my wife sometimes calls me an old fart, you know, and it was crazy because when I was young in my faith, I thought for sure God was going to have me work in youth ministry. I had no idea I'd be doing what I'm doing today. So anyways, but it was great to me because you got so many young people and how they're passionate about God. And we thought, well, this would be a great place for our, you know, daughters like that to come to too. And because there's so many different youths and so forth and all that. And just felt moved, and I enjoyed the preaching and so forth here. And my wife, she likes more of preaching tours, more like you preach. I like your preaching too, but also sometimes there's also a lot of theology comes in. Theology comes in from also. Mm-hmm. And so I'm a mixture between what Pastor Craig does and what you do, you both together, right? So, and then I think what really opened up is when Engedi was volunteering at, Gateway, and I seen some volunteers come in, they do their little bit of time, whatever, they're gone, but it was more than that. You guys came in, it was like they worked above what I expected, and they showed love in what they was doing, and that's what kept me here.
Okay.
And on top of that, believe it or not, the time we met there, meeting me might have been something, but when I saw you, you could have just came in there and just did your time. But instead, I saw you actually ministering to the people and stuff like that. And to me, that reminded me of Pastor Sam from Grand Rapids First. That's the kind of stuff he would do. Mm. So that meant a lot to me. Mm. And so that's what really start making a difference. The reason why this is home.
Yeah, thanks for saying that. Yeah. I appreciate the encouragement. And actually, one of those conversations that I had, I have not forgotten with a lady that was serving that day. And in fact, she's going to be, her story is going to be a big part of my message this week. Yeah. And I just felt like that was one of those gifts. Whenever you whenever you choose to serve people and to care and to ask questions and all that, I just feel like you're blessed so significantly in return. I wasn't doing that so I could be blessed, so to speak. Right. But in the process of just asking people how they were doing and what their backstory was and whatnot, she shared something with me that was really powerful, and I'm going to share that this Sunday. And I'm really, it's stuck with me. I think about it all the time. That it's going to be a great takeaway for people. So, well, I just really, really appreciate you being willing to share today, Dennis. And I know your journey is going to encourage so many people. Watching you, like I said this earlier, but watching you serve at Gateway, the compassion that you show, the leadership you show, the passion for the organization that you show, it's really uncommon. I feel like God has gifted you in so many different ways. And I remember when you said you did a personality test and your wiring was the same as Pastor Craig at Central. Yeah. And Craig's a friend, and I thought that was pretty cool. I thought, well, you know, I don't know. Maybe you're going to be the next guy at Central here. Maybe you'll take my place. I don't know. So anyway, I just think, though, you're a tremendous leader. Yeah. And I think God's got you appointed at the exact time and place that he needs you to be, and you're being faithful with that. And it was truly, truly inspiring. Yeah. To spend time with you on that day and then to spend time with you today. So thanks for chatting, and I look forward to sharing your story with many.
Ain't no doubt.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Dennis, and it really impacted me. I loved hearing how some folks took a risk on him when he got out of prison and were willing to invest in him and invest in that relationship. And that is honestly a big part of why he is where he is at today. And I also appreciated those examples he shared of when people were willing to do little things, even giving him a sandwich or buying him a smoothie. And that for him was very tangible encouragement and tangible expressions of the hands and feet of Jesus to say, hey, God saying, I see you. And so just remember that those small things matter in our daily lives. And so I hope you were encouraged today. I hope you were challenged by that conversation. And if you were, please rate and review us. That helps us get the word out about our podcast. This has been a production of Engedi Church, and we have more incredible conversations on the way. And so until next time, just know God made you to advance.